Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Hello, dear friends. I'm your head mister, Lord Stefan Gearhart.
And I am your co-mister, the man with no name, Lance Wayne.
And together we are the Misters of the... let's try it again. The Misters of the Lance!
The Misters of the Dark!
Don't shut up! Ugh, whatever. Join us wherever you stream your favorite podcasts, or go to mistersofthedark.com, where we'll be discussing all things horror, from films and books to everything in betweensies. We also have the occasional victim. I mean, guest.
Only on the Fearscape Media Network.
Shut up, Lance! No. I always get the last laugh.
There are phenomena that exist all around us.
Kids playing
above something, and above something unknown flies over and disappears. People driving at night, seeing huge creatures cross the road. People waking up to find their cabinet door ripped open in their kitchen.
Strange things happen every day around the world, seemingly at the same time and area.
But are these occurrences connected? This is what we are here to explore and are trying to understand.
Join us on our journey to uncover what we call the Convergence Enigma.
Welcome everyone to the Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan, formerly Fearscape Paranormal Podcast, here on the Fearscape Media Network. I am your host, Stefan Gearhart, and I am joined, as always, by my favorite Fortean investigator, Mr. Josh Rutledge.
Hello. Thank you for that heartfelt introduction.
All right, now that that's done. No, I'm just joking. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, much better than the last time when you said I look like a comparison between like a Twinkie and a Care Bear. So
I mean, it's not, I wasn't wrong, but you know, seriously though, most of you have noticed our name has changed. We are no longer Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. We are now the Convergence Enigma. If you follow us on social media, you will now see the reason for this. Has been a long time coming. We just moved it a little faster than we planned, just because the slate of guests we've got coming on, the topics that we've got coming up over the next few weeks, it was time,
anybody who's listened over the last probably 18 months will have already picked up on the fact that when we cover a topic, when we talk to a guest, we don't look at one aspect of whatever it is. So this is just a continuation, almost like an official announcement that, hey, that's where we're going to shift the focus to, is looking at everything and how it converges together.
Exactly. You know, that's exactly what we're saying. Whether it be Sasquatch, ghost sighting, UFOs, UAPs, whatnot, we know that somehow it all leads together. Even some of this Shaver Mystery Hollow Earth stuff that we're getting into, if you followed some of the stuff going on with Wristwatch and that whole adventure, so much has just been leading to that thought pattern that all these high strangeness paranormal roads all lead to the same thing. Our biggest example we always talk about is the Enfield haunting in England, and at that same time that haunting was going on, there was a huge UFO flap, as well as numerous Sasquatch sightings within the area, all within a few weeks, all right there. John Keel very much talked about this phenomena in his own words quite frequently. So, thus is the reason why we are now the Convergence Enigma, because we are going to really shift our focus to exploring that enigma and why and even how it all comes together like that.
Yeah. So anybody who's listening who has some convergence type things. Those are the things we really want to know about. We want to dig into, we want to try to figure out what are the data points here? Where does it point us to? So we have a new email address you can now hit us at contact@theconvergenceenigma.com. Drop us those things. Let us know what you're seeing. Let us know what you're experiencing. We want to dig into it.
Yep. And the first start of that is us welcoming back a Fearscape guest alum. Mr. Jeremy McGowan is going to be on the show tonight, the man behind the Osiris, but he is also now a huge part of the UAPX project that is out there that is happening, that is just taking his research essentially and those of Kevin Day and those with the Nimitz and things like that and making it even more reliable and bigger on a bigger scale. So we're going to be talking to Jeremy tonight, so stick around for that. But of course, before we get to that, let's get to our very first segment, which is Psychic Term of the Week.
And now, the Psychic Word of the Week.
All right, Josh, Psychic Term of the Week comes from the Encyclopedic Psychic Dictionary by Dr. Junji Bletzer. Rest in peace, Honey Bear. She is always guiding me, in my opinion. And I asked her to find something really fun. So I flipped through the pages and I stuck my finger down. I landed on page 439 and I landed on the occult police. And I said, Junji Bletzer, gods love you. Gods love you. So here's what the occult police is. The definition reads, highly intelligent etheric world intelligences who concern themselves with psychism applied toward criminal ends and offense against society, answerable to anyone who needs help and calls upon them through telepathic communication. So I mean, this is psychic help.
It really is.
Helpline, man.
Yep, it's you just close your eyes and call for help.
It's like our girl that runs the
paranormal help desk.
Paranormal help desk. I couldn't think, I was going to say the ghost helpline, paranormal help desk. Like this is that, but for psychic stuff, right?
So yep. Yeah.
So very cool. Yeah, so that there are entities or even persons that are out there that are willing to hear you out and listen and be there. And I love that. I love that there's this idea that we can be saved, because what did we talk about? Was it last week or the week before where we had that listener story that had the Hat Man, right? And there was part of the lore of the Hat Man was attacking you while you were astral traveling.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and so that's when I'm like, I'm about to call psychic 911.
What makes you wonder if those psychic police are actually out patrolling the astral plane?
Maybe. I will say, Josh, when you were here in Arizona in December, I feel like we had done a session and came across an entity that basically said he was a spirit cop. Like, I don't know if you recall, I think you were channeling, I can't recall. But yeah, it was essentially someone saying, yeah, I keep an eye on things. There's a dimensional pathway or gateway or something along those lines near here that spirits are entering through. And it's my job to watch and patrol.
Yeah, so I do, having gone back and listened to the recording, I do recall that coming up. And it's interesting that at the time, we didn't think anything of it, but now having read this term,
you know, occult police, here we are, Junji Bletzer, man. Where were you 2 months ago?
So, but yeah, that's very cool. Thanks, Stefan.
Yeah, no worries. Always here for you, man. I got you. All right, well, let's go ahead and move to our segment before we get to Jeremy McGowan and UAPX, which this week is going to be our UAP sighting of the week. All right, Josh, UAP sighting of the week. What do we got? Where's it from? And why did you choose this?
This comes from Columbia, South Carolina. Happened 12/23/21. So just a couple of days before Christmas.
Are you pulling this from MUFON?
I did pull it from MUFON. I did. And the reason I picked this is I randomly selected it. So,
and that, ladies and gentlemen, see, I try to blame Junji Bletzer for mine. So go ahead.
Yeah. So goes like this.
Through the sunroof while my wife was shopping for shoes, I noticed what I thought was a satellite because of altitude and speed. Then I wondered why it would be visible in daylight so clearly. They're hard enough to see at night. So it passed in a straight path through where I could no longer see it through the sunroof. I got out of my car in the mall area parking lot and tried to reacquire it visually. It took a few seconds because it was a very bright day, hardly any clouds though, and I found it again as suddenly its flight path changed. It had been going almost straight north from the south, then about 45 degrees above the horizon or so, it stopped and began moving towards the east. At times it would disappear, then reappear in the same general area, where before it had been going straight, and at the same constant high speed, it was now moving much more slowly and not in a straight line, but more of a ziggy-zaggy through the air. That was when I noticed a second craft, completely identical to it, behind it in the sky, flying with it, but not connected to it, because they move independently, sort of up and down. I couldn't just how far away from where one from the other, but it was between 2 to 3 fingers if you hold it up to the sky. They appear to be plain, for lack of a better word, and one would seem to turn off and on separately, though only very briefly. I took a video from my cell phone knowing it would be crappy so far away on a bright cloudless day, but I did catch them.
So, first of all, what is ziggy zaggy? I never heard.
You know, like a lightning bolt type.
No,
thing.
I know that, but I wouldn't have said ziggy zaggy. I would have said zigzag. But whatever, ziggy zaggy, I love that. It's also the sequel to Ziggy comics, in case you were wondering.
It's his wife.
It is. Oh, see, now I like that. But no, dude, the second this guy said, oh, there's another one behind it, I was like, oh, I'm in. And like, I was just drawn right back in. Like, it's already crazy enough to see one, or even one that's in formation with others, right? That those are yeah. pretty common sightings, but to see them play and to like dogfight jokingly, I guess, how to speak, that almost feels to me more some along the lines of Chris Alexander's Lights in the Skies, right? That they're these entities that would fly around like the Fae would or the Fairy would.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the playing around was very interesting. The fact that it was proceeding on a straight line and then changed. I mean, that alone, the stop and a change of direction is enough to set it apart from almost any other aircraft that we know. The only other thing, and of course, I didn't see it, right? So the only other thing that comes to mind is a drone.
But I mean, can a drone move like that, especially two of them?
I mean, if they were kind of moving around the sky playing with each other, you could have a drone that's flying along and all of a sudden somebody else flies another drone up there and starts interacting with it.
I don't know, man. This is one of those things where it's like, I wish I could see with my own eyes.
I know.
To see what it's meant by playing with each other. Because if they're making sharp right angle turns quickly and things like that, I'm ruling out drone real quick.
Yeah. I mean, I would too. And you know, he does talk about how like they seem to like turn on and off, like they become visible and then not visible and then they're visible and not like. That to me, you know, like a drone would be like a constant kind of, you know, shape in the sky, right? It wouldn't, especially in the daylight. In the nighttime, it could have lights that turn off and turn back on, but in the daytime, they're either visible or they're not. So,
well, Josh, speaking of UAP, I wanted to bring this up. You and I were on a road trip across country to bring some of your stuff to Arizona. We don't have time for a full creepy catch up tonight, but I did want to have you talk about the sighting that you caught on the Psionics while we were stuck in the desert in New Mexico for a few hours.
Yeah, so I'll give the abridged version. I'm sure this is the version my wife would have much rather be given than the full. But so yeah, right, we got off the highway because it was like a nice dark area, we wouldn't see the stars, got the truck stock, stuck in the dirt. But while waiting on the tow truck, decided to still take advantage of it and look at the night sky.
Because, yeah, we were in the middle of nowhere, eastern New Mexico.
I mean, the sky was just amazing.
Yeah, we were on the other side of Tucumcari, in between Amarillo and Tucumcari, New Mexico, just out in the middle of the desert. It was incredible.
Like, there was like a ghost town right up the road that was abandoned along Route 66. It was pretty cool. But anyway, so I broke out the psionics, and I was just... kind of taking, you know, again, video of the night sky. And it was odd. Like, I thought in my head, I thought, hey, if there's anything out there that wants to be seen tonight, I'm here and I'm videoing. And then I caught this light that just kind of like comes out of nowhere. It moves across the sky and then it disappears again. And it's like, it's moving too slow to be, in my opinion, too slow to be like a meteorite or something. Too fast to be, or, you know, too, I guess, even fast to be like an aircraft or something. We did check, you know, flight radar 24 and all the satellite stuff and all that kind of stuff. And it doesn't look like any of those things, and nor was there anything out there. And I even remember remarking to you about how when we go out recently, when we go out, we don't see any satellites. Like, every time we've gone out the last couple of times, we don't see any satellites. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is up on our YouTube station, our YouTube channel.
Which you guys can see that, youtube.com/fearscapemedia. Check that out, because it is on there. I'd love to have everybody's opinion, because I've looked at it 1,000 times. I was there. It sits in the sky for a long time and streaks for too long up high. It doesn't feel like a meteorite to me, especially the way it just continued to glide across the sky.
And I've seen the meteorites that like kind of glance off the atmosphere, like you see them a little bit and they're gone. I've seen those, and that's not what this is. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. It was quite fascinating. But again, check that out. Let us know. Thank you, Josh, for sharing that. But all right, if you're ready and I'm ready to get talking to Jeremy McGowan and talk about UAPX.
Welcome back, everybody, here on the Convergence Enigma. We are talking with our really good friend here, Mr. Jeremy McGowan.
Welcome back, sir. Nice. Dude, it is. I think we were just chatting that I think it's been close to a year since we've seen each other.
Yeah, almost a year.
Almost. And in that time, I think Josh is now moving out to Phoenix. Like, he's going to be out here now. I mean, I got a baby coming in April. I mean, it's all kinds of stuff has happened in a year, man.
Man, it's gone by so fast.
How's the skies?
Full of weird stuff that I can't explain yet.
Yeah.
We can't either. I do know one of the big reasons we were anxious to have you on was to talk about the nonprofit research organization, UAPX. Mm-hmm. We do also like you, of course, and we want to talk, you know, to you about OSIRIS and different stuff like that. But we are very anxious to start talking about UAPX. So I'm going to hand it over to Josh, let him do his thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of my understanding, Jeremy, is that, you know, when we had you on to talk about OSIRIS and the OSIRIS project, you really wanted to take the data that you collected with OSIRIS and make it available to the people for them to come through, for them to figure out, you know, what this thing is. And that's kind of what UAPX is at a broader scale. Is that right?
Yeah, I was so lucky to get involved with UAPX because literally, as you guys have said, it's a larger version of the vision that I had for the OSIRIS project. You know, it's a group of people from all walks of life. We have two physicists, PhD type of physicists that work with University of Albany SUNY. We have one PhD candidate who is a NASA trained commercial astronaut. He was actually instrumental in working on a joint Air Force and NASA, believe it or not, time travel project.
Wow.
Yeah. Legit thing. I had to look it up. and then of course we've got Gary Voorhees, Kevin Day, and Jason Turner, who were all aboard the USS Princeton, part of the Nimitz battle group, during the now infamous 2004 Tic Tac event. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the amount of expertise that we have, the amount of equipment that we have, and the singular shared vision that we have amongst us, it is taking the OSIRIS and putting it on steroids.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm a huge Kevin Day fan. I think most people are aware of Kevin Day. I think his face and voice seems to be the most seen. And boy, if there's someone that you're like, just right off the bat, whether it's on TV or in person, that you're like, I believe this guy. It's yeah. Kevin Day, man. There's just something about him that
he wears everything on his sleeve. I mean,
yeah, it's exactly right the way there. You put it. Like, you right know, this there. Guy's not pulling your finger. Yeah. Well, unless you asked him to, you know, then he might pull. He's a nice guy. I'll pull your finger. What do you want? But he just strikes me as a pretty honest guy. And that
down to earth. Yeah.
Stands out to me more than anyone in the last few years in any of this UAP UFO stuff that's out there. Like, if Kevin Day's speaking, I'm listening.
Well, and it's I had the honor and privilege of being able to work with him for a good solid portion of one of our major expeditions that we did with UAPX, and Kevin was right there every morning and stayed with us until we were hitting the bunks again, and he busted his ass just around with the rest of us. So amazing. Well,
I
mean, guy.
I remember the first time I think I saw him being interviewed, you know, I don't remember what show it was or whatever, but it's kind of one of the first interviews that he did. And what really struck me is he seemed very reluctant to do the interview, not because he didn't agree with whatever was being discussed, but just I don't think he's seeking out the limelight, right? He's not seeking out the attention. People are asking him questions. He's providing his information, but he's not seeking attention. He's not seeking glory and fame. So.
Yeah. And you know, none of us at UAPX are after that. We've had the devils that we've had to dance with. Mm-hmm. Because science is expensive. And these expeditions that we put together, they're not cheap. I mean, our major expedition that was completed mid last year, we had over $500,000 of equipment. Some of it was on loan from universities. Some of it was privately owned. Some of it was stuff that we built, bought, or otherwise manufactured ourselves. But just the shipping, the room, the board, the insurance, the safety, all things considered, you know, about 5 to 7 days worth of work cost roughly $60,000. So as a nonprofit startup, you know, we're not funded. We don't have that in our pockets. Right. So when somebody comes over to us and says, hey, I'm going to fund your guys' entire expedition in exchange for being allowed to watch, that's the devil that we have to dance with. Right. So, but I wanted to make sure that everybody understands that we do not bend the data or the facts or the measurements to fit the narrative of whomever is funding us. So,
yeah, I mean, I remember that when we had you on, when we talked about the OSIRIS stuff, is that, you know, you're a big proponent of, if you go out and do an investigation and you don't find anything, still present what you didn't find, right? Still present whatever the data was, even though it may not point to whatever narrative somebody's trying to spin. And I really appreciate that, because there are times we talked about it when you were on before, when, you know, you watch these shows on TV and it's result after result after result. And it's just hard to believe that they kept, you know, hitting the mark every single time. And you really know that they're not. And so
it's like
really
watching a pro golfer doing nothing but holes in one. You know, that doesn't happen.
Right. Exactly.
Happy Gilmore.
Yeah, there you go.
But Josh, it was like, we were chatting with somebody last night, a friend of ours, and you had mentioned that it was like, even zero evidence, zero results is still a result. Like,
it's a measured data point. Absolutely. You know, and it can tell you one of two things. Well, it can tell you a number of different things, but the primary two things that it can tell you is either you're doing things wrong, or the equipment that you have is not suited for the task.
Yes.
So if you get no results, I mean, if you're out sky watching, you should see something, whether it's birds, bugs, airplanes, hang gliders, paragliders, helicopters, you should see something. Mm-hmm. If you get nothing, something's wrong.
Yep. Right. You know, it's one of the things I remember John Keel, when he collected all of his data together to write what was the book, The Eighth Tower. And, you know, I guess he's put together a narrative. And so he collected all this sighting data over several years from newspaper articles that were being mailed to him and such. And he basically came up with, you know, Wednesdays and Saturdays are the best times to see UFOs and UAPs, you know, between the hours of like 10 and 2 a.m. Of course, this is all, you know, set on data back in the 60s, but, and then for some reason, June 24th.
June 24th. I was going to say that.
Yeah. Is a significant date for UAP research and all the stuff that
what
he collected.
Is June 24th. What is that?
There were like three dates I think he had picked that through all the research and things that he had done that more high strangeness, paranormal, whatever activity correlated and happened on June 24th. And I believe two other dates. I can't remember. June 24th was like the main one that in history, more things happened on that date than any other date. So that was like another one of his points was, was it Wednesdays and Saturdays and June 24th and these two other dates. I wish I had them handy right now.
But the idea that, you know, he had to collect all of that data, right? Even data where things didn't happen to be able to narrow it down to these are the best times and dates for you to go out and see stuff. So,
you know, that's an interesting thing. We've never looked at correlating the saturation level of events with specific dates and times for, you know, looking back in history. Mm-hmm. That'd be something I'd be interested in taking a deeper dive in.
Right.
Well, you know, I even wonder because, you know, so much we were talking about it the other night with another show we do that with Starlink, since the launch of Starlink, so many reports are Starlink reports. I mean, we usually do a segment on the show where we do, you know, UAP sighting of the week. I jump out to MUFON and I try to find a good UAP sighting to report back to our audience. And there are so many that I see. I saw a string of lights moving across the sky and it's just, you know, it almost be to say, go back to before Starlink was first launched. And that's the data you care about, because I think since then you're going to have a lot of false reports that you're going
to get. I mean, it makes me even want to go to MUFON and say, can I clean up your database?
Well, you would think. Yes. And you would think that we've now had the five observables, six technically, for the better part of almost 3 years now.
Yeah.
Why aren't people filtering their events by at least the five observables?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when Hynek came out with his close encounters, boy, everybody was checking what type of close encounter they had. But yeah, these five observables aren't
they're not being used.
Yeah. I mean, think about that.
A string of small lights going across the sky is literally zero of the five observables.
Right. The other thing is, and I don't know, I've emailed some folks to ask about, but as a MUFON member, you know, I can go out and I can search the reporting database. But I see really the public facing report. So I see what everybody put in with their images and all that kind of stuff. I'd love to see what MUFON investigators are tagging these things at, because I would imagine that as an investigator, they have some sort of another database or another view of the database, even where they're classifying things as Starlink or whatever the case may be. I'd love to get my hands on that detail.
So. Yeah, I have no idea how MUFON works.
Yeah, I know. But it would just, you know, if they're really about data sharing, it would think that, you know, they would make some of that stuff available. So. But anyways, back to UAPX. I do want to also say we were talking to someone a couple weeks back, and they were kind of hitting UAPX a little hard because there was some footage that they had that UAPX wouldn't look at. And I was looking out at your all's website, you know, the other day, and I noticed that there's kind of like your rules of engagement, if you will.
Which I'm looking at right now.
And one of them is you don't look at anybody else's data than your own.
No, we're not going to.
Right. So it's not that you know that you singled out this guy, you know, just that's your general rule.
Yeah. Data that is collected by somebody else is not going to be reviewed for scientific measurements by UAPX unless it comes from a source of provenance. We understand their method of data collection. They have all the I's dotted, all the T's crossed. You know, it's somebody that has gone out and maybe they've published their own papers before or had their papers published, or they're you know, instrumental in this research. But if somebody just sends us a video or a still picture or a collection of pictures,
yeah,
we know nothing. We don't know the camera type. We don't know when they were there. We don't know where they were. They probably don't even know the azimuth or the directionality that their camera was pointed in. They probably don't have a secondary PDF telling us what the weather, the temperature, the humidity, and, you know, the UV index was. There's probably been no records or recording of any flight tracks from like Flight Radar 24 or anything, not even the most basic minuscule amount of information. So why would somebody expect an organization such as us that uses, you know, $500,000 worth of scientific equipment to do these same studies to take our physicists and our researchers and say, hey, can you sit down and take 2 or 3 hours of your very valuable time and look at Bob's Polaroid? It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, you're not MUFON, right? I mean, that's what MUFON is. Yeah. MUFON collects this type of data and they look at it and have fun with it and go from there. Where if you were open to that, you don't have time for the amount of, excuse me, but shit you would get, like, you know, just the amount of stuff that would come across the board.
The string of lights moving across the sky.
When you, so you do indeed, you have all that information there that you're using. I would want that as someone looking at UAPX. I'd rather have that than a video some guy in Venezuela sent you.
Yeah. And just so you guys know, even our own data that we record ourselves, our analysis isn't just, you know, us sitting down over a cup of coffee, looking at a picture and going, it's a UFO. No, we're writing custom neural nets, customized AI and machine learning applications to do, you know, super imaging resolution and size and shape analysis. We're looking at tertiary sources of information that can back up what we know to be a triangulation point. You know, we go to LIGO or ERNIE or, you know, pull information from NEXRAD weather radar just to confirm that there was an object that one of our cameras saw. Then we go back to all of our ancillary equipment and say, okay, what was the temperature on the FLIR? Did the quantum random number generator jump any? Do we have anything on the cosmic watch? Do we have any other ancillary data? Right. Our images, even our own images to us, don't mean crap.
Yeah. Just like you said, you're not sitting there looking at a picture going, well, that's good enough for History Channel.
Right.
But it does sound like, because we do have some amateur UFO hunters in Kentucky, they're the same way. They're like, well, Earl's hair was standing up. That's pretty standard. We got there. He's got his jar of moonshine was bubbling. Okay. That doesn't normally happen unless it's a full moon. So, you know, there's data points in different places, man.
Yeah, but there is. Our place is deeply, deeply rooted into repeatable, testable, measurable, and understandable. And, you know, we're not going to take a photograph of a flock of birds and call it something that it's not.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and I don't want to discourage people from going out and taking these pictures and trying to do their own research and study. But we're not the organization that is going to research those.
Yeah. That's not your guys' focus.
No.
And, you know, just as a reminder, like you just said, if you're going to be that person, if you're going to go out in a field close to your house and take a psionics or just a camera or whatever and go out there and try to catch something, record the time that you see it, record what the temperature was, what direction were you facing, how far off the horizon was it. I'll like record all that extra detail along with your picture, because even though you all UAPX is not going to look at it, when you submit your MUFON report, if you do, and you provide all that additional detail, you're more likely to get a call from a MUFON investigator to figure out what's going on there than just saying, here's a picture of a still picture that I took of something in the night sky.
And your call with MUFON investigator will last less than 2 hours, like mine did, because I didn't write any of that stuff down. They're like, well, do you know what the temperature was? I'm like, it was Christmas in Phoenix.
And you know, even one of the things I had an interesting experience when I was in the military, not UFO related, but I was in I was in Kuwait during Desert Storm. And I was out on desert patrol with my fire team, and way off in the distance, we saw AAA fire, anti-aircraft artillery fire, going up in the air. It wasn't a direct threat to us because we're on the ground, but we had to call it in. And the biggest thing that we could do at that moment was just take the heel of our boots and mark the location of where we were and draw a big old arrow in the sand pointing at the direction of where the AAA fire was coming in. So when the sun comes up the next morning, you know, we could do a better triangulation and a better understanding of exactly where it was. So, I mean, you know, if you're out at night and you don't record the data, mark something, take a knife and scratch an arrow on the side of the sidewalk or something pointing at the direction that you were, you know, where you were standing and the direction you were looking, just for future reference.
And also, I mean, something that I try to do anytime that I have a sighting that I'm not sure about, if I don't get a picture or even if I do, is I like come home and I write down my experience. You know, I journal it out, if you will.
Yeah.
The thing that I saw, I note if I noticed if it was breezy or if the moon was out or if I saw any other stars or whatever the case would be, because you're probably going to forget that information by the time it comes time to talk to somebody about it. So,
yeah. Yeah, there's so many apps out there on the phone. I mean, if you're doing amateur, and I don't mean amateur in a bad way. I just mean with a professional organization.
Right.
If you're doing these UFO UAP sighting events, you know, download the Skyscanner app, download Flight Radar 24, and try to prove yourself wrong before anybody else drags you over the coals.
Yep. I mean, we do. It's something we learned with our own stuff is Flight Radar 24, the Starlink app to find where Starlink is. There's a Sky Safari that we use for like where all those different satellites are, where the International Space Station is and everything. So, yeah, like you said, try to prove yourself wrong before you go public and somebody points out that it's the International Space
Station. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So I do want to talk real quick about OSIRIS, because I am very interested in what you've got going on.
We're still obsessed with OSIRIS.
I know that you've added some additional equipment since we last talked, because I've been following you as you build some things and things like that. Are you still going strong with the OSIRIS rig, or
the OSIRIS is currently down for a refit and a redo. After our primary expedition that we completed last year, there was a lot of things, a lot of lessons learned about how the OSIRIS operates, what it's capable of. There were some instances in not on our primary expedition, but a secondary one, where I managed to capture an object. I'm not even going to say if it was UAP or not, but an object appeared in the visual field of one camera, but it wasn't being picked up by the second camera, even though both cameras were the same makes and the same sensors and the same everything. It didn't appear in one and it did in the other. So, you know, I'm trying to replot where the equipment goes.
Yeah.
I've added some RF signal analyzers and all sorts of other types of non-imaging sensor technology to the vehicle, because I think it's really, really important to get a decent photo or video, but it's not nearly as important as having the secondary measurements, you know, radiation detection. Yeah. With UAPX, we're currently building a very large rooftop sized cosmic ray detector that is going to be integrated into the OSIRIS. We're building, it's unimaginable the stuff that we're putting into this vehicle.
Have you all looked at doing a radio telescope as well?
Not necessarily a radio telescope, but I have started on the very early stages of building what's called a passive radar. So the difference between an active radar and a passive radar is active radar actually beams out the radar waves, and it uses the object as a reflective source, and it receives the reflectivity of that radar signal. Highly regulated by the FCC. You have to have licenses and all sorts of things. We can't do that, right? A passive radar is basically a radar receiver, but our airways are filled with radio stations and television broadcasts and CB and all these other transmissions that are going out. These are all being reflected just like a regular radar is, right? So in building just the receiver side of it, we can actually create through software a 3D map of the aerial environment around the OSIRIS.
Well, that's awesome. and I really want to see it. But
it's getting there. It's getting there. But you know, again, this stuff isn't cheap.
No, I know. I think I saw you were looking a couple months back on Instagram for like an old antenna, like a house antenna. I guess maybe that was for something that you're working on there, but or like a motor where you could turn the antenna. So
I actually ended up building that.
You're trying to pick up the honeymooners.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I now on the front of the Osiris, on the hood of the Osiris, I have a very focused antenna that will sweep back and forth, and it will display on my software-defined radio display in the front seat. I will be able to see the spectrographic readout of the RF spectrum. And once I isolate a certain signal, I can stop the antenna and stop it from, you know, panning. And then I can actually move the Osiris, because it's a vehicle, and look for the decibel increase in the signal and try to locate the source of a signal.
That's... The tech side of me is exploding right now. So no, that's just amazing. I'm speechless. When I get out to Arizona, we're definitely gonna have to get together. I'm gonna have to just drool over your rig. I'll clean it up though. So
speaking of hot breath,
really.
My question to you is, and answer this if you can or not, I don't know. But I feel, you know, you guys, one of the big things that points out is, hey, we're doing all this stuff. One of the things here it talks about is reviewing and analyzing data to fill in the gaps, in sensor technology identified by the U.S. government, but without governmental involvement. Have they been breathing down your necks, the government?
Not directly. We don't typically trust the U.S. government. I mean, they've lied about this whole UFO phenomenon to the general public for at least the last 70 years. So whatever they come out with has to be taken with a grain of salt in whatever regard they say it has. We don't know if we're being monitored. There's no way for us to know if we're being monitored. But there was a hard drive that we were mailing to other members of our team that contained, well, the hard drive was alleged to have contained some data on it, and it went missing from a mail room. Just disappeared. The package arrived, the content did not. Luckily for us, we had it was basically a test. The hard drive was blank, but the information that we had put out prior to mailing it to our internal team was that, you know, hey, this is going to contain this data, and that that hard drive went missing.
Interesting. You know, when your life starts to look like a movie or X-Files or something like that, it's time to be like, I think we're on the right track here.
Like, and then I also had another hard drive that was actually stolen out of the Osiris.
Jeez. That's crazy, man.
And it was with all the equipment that I've got in the Osiris, the only thing that was was the hard drive.
Yeah, but you just like you said, you know, like today when we recorded this, so this was a week prior, on the debrief, Chris Mellon had an article that came out and just did an interview with Chrissy Newton. And he's basically calling out the Air Force saying, hey, why have you guys been AWOL through all of this?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's interesting to be talking about the government here. And yet here we are.
Well, you know, believe it or not, I don't think the Air Force has much.
Oh, I don't either. But I still think they're still got a little Project Blue Book shy.
Well, if you think about it, the Air Force probably doesn't have much, because anything that the majority of people would ascribe as Air Force technology is probably agency owned and operated, or NRO owned and operated under the flag of the U.S. Air Force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, didn't even think about that, but yeah, absolutely. Now, what about Space Force, guys?
You know, it's too early to tell.
I know. What, I mean, what has
I do have Space high Force, hopes for it, but
what has Space Force done since their inception?
I think they've created their uniform.
Yeah. Which is almost identical to the TV show, which is really, if you watch the
Battlestar Galactica.
No. Just the space.
No, the Space Force show on Netflix
with Steven, whatever his name is,
Carell.
Steve Carell.
Steve Carell. Yeah. It is hilarious, but it is literally what's kind of all they've done. Cause like the first two or three episodes was literally about choosing the uniform and things like that. And then here we are months, you know, a year later, whatever, from the, just that show airing, and you're starting to see some of those things that happened in the show. I'm like, are y'all even watching the show? Cause you're making fun of yourselves. You don't realize it. And season two is about to drop. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll be watching that too. But it's funny because, you know, like any good writing, there's always some real truth mixed in.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, oh, yeah. That's they've got advisors on the show.
Oh, yeah. I'm,
Hands down. Hands down.
It's Richard Dean Anderson. He's advising them. So
now that would actually be awesome. He's one of the few celebrities that I would actually like to sit down with and have a beer.
Yeah, Hall.
I just I would just be mad because I would want to bring him like some duct tape, a plastic cup, some dog hairs, and a plunger, and I would be like, I need you to make me a bomb. Right? And if he didn't do it, I'd be really upset. And so I can't. That's one of those things where they say you don't want to meet your heroes, and I think that might be one of them.
Well, see, I know you were never a Stargate fan, Stefan. So that's where
I'm a Stargate movie fan.
Yeah. But yeah,
with so, the kid from that weird movie that I can't think of.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Think of it now. Camera.
So, I know that you are not allowed to talk a lot about this, but I don't know if you can give us.
But
I don't know if you can give us just like a little tease. Okay. You all did some stuff last year that's going to be released in some sort of a video format in the near future.
Yeah, so our NDA was very specific, and it told us that we could not discuss anything that had not been publicly disclosed. Luckily for you and your audience, the production company sent out a tweet yesterday saying that the trailer to this film would be released very soon. So it is out there in public knowledge that UAPX did in fact participate in a documentary event on one of our expeditions.
Excellent. I cannot wait. And we will obviously be sharing that bad boy out. So
yeah, it's, you know, it was a really fun project to do. Obviously, you know, it was what enabled our expedition. And we're extremely grateful for having the opportunity to go out and be able to collect actionable data on the UFO UAP phenomena. What I am truly, truly excited about, you would think that being in a documentary that's getting released and things like that would be, you know, the heart pump, but I'm really, truly excited for our scientific papers to get published and get released. That's what has me personally truly vested in this whole project.
You know, I am too. And the reason I'll say so is because I remember before Unidentified came out and all of that came out, there were a number of us that already had our fingers dipped into To the Stars Academy and the papers that they were pushing, the things that they were putting out there. And I was reading those every chance that I got. And it seemed like when Unidentified came out, those kind of quit. And so it's kind of like, it kind of, it's weird. And now I know we got Lou and them, they left TTSA, and that's fine, whatever. And I guess Tom wants to do a little more entertainment-y type things, but I miss that research. That's why something hearing you guys talk, UAPX, I'm like, this is again back to, in some ways, back to what I was so excited about To the Stars about in the very beginning, was just this information and this research being put out publicly. And
And we're doing things a little differently as well, because not only are we going to come out with the scientific papers, but we're going to release the raw data at the same time or near the same time that the papers come out, in the hopes, because, you know, we're not in this for a Nobel Prize. We're not in this for fame or fortune. We're in this for answers. So obviously our physicists get the first crack at our data, and the papers that they write and get published are going to be the first representation of the quality of the data. But we also want the rest of the world to be able to review everything that we did. So we're going to give access to academia and to science and to universities, all of our raw data, so that they can start from zero and try to either prove us correct or prove us wrong, or say, holy crap, you guys missed this, or something, right? Because again, we're not looking for the Nobel Prize. We're looking for the correct answer.
You're looking for collaboration towards the truth.
Yes. Yes.
So I did want to say I think I saw something early on when you first kind of joined UAPX, and I could be wrong, but did you all kind of shift your focus from land to sea at some point?
I think it's vice versa.
Okay.
It was more sea to land. Obviously, Kevin Daigh and Gary Voorhees and Jason Turner were the original three for UAPX. Mm-hmm. And being in the Navy, it was an obvious, go to do what you know. They all spent years and decades upon decades collectively in United States Navy. So it only made sense for them to want the original idea of UAPX was to get a charter fleet put together with the sensor technology and go back to the Catalina Channel and try to study the phenomenon as it had occurred to the Nimitz battle group, recreate as much of the environment as they could and drop the sensors and try to pick up on something if it was repeatable in the Catalina Channel. After Gary had sat down and put pen to paper and figured out what the budget for that would be, it was like, let's stick to the dirt.
Yeah. Have you all looked at using, and you may have, but like the national, I'm going to totally blank on the name, but the people who monitor seismic activity, I'm totally blank, geo, but to see if there's stuff that's going on even underground that might be worth detecting.
We talk to everyone. As a matter of fact, I've got an email, if I could show you, I would, but at one of our major expeditions, we detected some anomalous radiation readings, and we don't know what caused them yet. We're still digging into that. Could likely be an undiscovered magnetar, which in and of itself would be a really cool discovery for us to have made. But the flux on this was so significant that I determined that it would probably be registered by radio stations and television stations and things like that. Mm. So, we've reached out to NOAA, the National Atmospheric or Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. We've reached out to LIGO and ERNIE, places like McMurdo Station in Antarctica to try to confirm, a lot of these readings that we're getting, all the way down to local television stations in that area to see if they maintain an interference log, just so we can get as much secondary and tertiary data that confirms dates and times and places and things like that.
Yeah, so it sounds like that you all really have your S together over there. So
we try. Now, we're not infallible, but we are probably going to make a million more mistakes than we do things right. But to my knowledge, this is the first time it's ever been done.
I mean, it's got to be better than the government at this point. So,
well, it's interesting you say that, because right now the equipment that UAPX has outside of the Spy One radar that was used on the Nimitz, we probably have better equipment for directly measuring alleged UAP than the U.S. government did in 2004.
Interesting.
I don't disagree with that at all.
I mean, it's technology, of course. The technology that you're using now was probably introduced to the military first, and then it became available in public hands, just like everything else is. So,
well, with the exception of one thing that we have, and to my understanding, I don't think anybody has ever used this, mostly because it just came out. But MIT designed what they call the Cosmic Watch, and it's not this type of watch. It's like this type of watch, right? Cosmic watching, but it is a scintillator device that is able to pick up cosmic rays. And then you can use statistical analysis to differentiate between gammas and muons and all sorts of energetic particles. But this was one of the key pieces of equipment that we utilized on our primary expedition.
So real quick, we only have a couple more minutes before I get to asking you about, all your plugs and everything like that. What's a typical day? Like, that's what I want to know. What's a typical day for UAPX when you guys saying today's the day? I mean, you're saying that Kevin Day's getting up with you guys and then they're hitting the bunks with you guys. What's a short version of a typical day for you guys when you're going out and doing research?
You know, if we're in the field, and this, God, it's not what I want it to be. Because like I said earlier, we have the devil that we have to dance with. Mm-hmm. So if our expedition is being funded by somebody making a documentary or making a TV show, sure, or something, you know, there are things that interfere with our day-to-day operations. I would love to be able to put together a fly on the wall type of production where there is no, okay, well, can you guys do this at 6 because union rules say they can't film, you know, whatever it is, right?
Sure.
Luckily for us, our equipment works with or without us.
Right.
So
yeah,
a typical day for UAPX is honestly not doing the boots on the ground research. It's the months and months and months afterwards where we're sitting down and we're analyzing.
Yeah.
We're running the numbers and the last 48 hours, I've been processing one Excel spreadsheet that has over 1,800,000 lines on it, where I plotted the location of every single AIS transmitting vessel on the globe, and then had to go back and isolate the ones that were not in a specific geographic area, pull out all the pleasure craft, and just look for the unknowns or the military vessels that were in the area to try to find what their capabilities would have been to go back and create a FOIA to look for the deck logs on those ships.
Wow.
It's the amount of post-processing in this stuff is insane.
Definitely some eye straining activity there. So
for sure. But Jeremy, thank you again. Where can they find information on the OSIRIS and UAPX and just anything else out there that you wanted to kind of shout out?
Yeah. So the UAPX website is really easy. It's just UAPX.space. It will default to our main website, but it's just easier to say UAPX.space. The OSIRIS and my personal page is just jeremydmcgowan.com.
Perfect. And I noticed on there real quick that there are some opportunities out there for people that want to volunteer. I thought that was really interesting.
They're coming. They're not
there yet.
They're
coming, yeah. So I know that that'll be, and I'm sure looking at data.
Well, the volunteers that we're looking for initially, when we're ready to mm-hmm. open up the floodgates, mm-hmm. is, you know, we're going to be looking for people that are C++ coders, Go,
right.
Golang guys, people that have experience in AI and machine learning. That's going to be first and foremost. Mm-hmm. So we're going to drop down to image analysis. Then we're probably going to be looking at geospatial intelligence type of folks with that expertise. Also, you know, if they're geophysicists, if they're astrophysicists, all of these types of expertise we're going to be looking for on a volunteer basis until we become funded.
Perfect. And yeah, keep your eyes peeled for that, folks. I know we have a lot of listeners that do a lot more stuff than we even realize. So keep your eyes open if you're interested in that.
And also, if you're on the UAPX Expeditions website, I noticed that you all have a Discord server.
Yes.
I just joined it. There looks like some pretty active conversation going on there. So
doing that now.
So it's a way to maybe get in on the action a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
And we actually have a weekly thing we do, which there's a Discord channel for it. It's called Ask a UAP Physicist.
Oh.
And every week we collect questions from the members of the UAPX Discord server. And then 1 to 3 or 4 of the questions are selected by our physicists, and they provide an answer that we then post both on the Discord and on the UAPX blog.
That's awesome. You're going to be like, Josh, stop sending in questions.
Yeah.
But no, thank you so much, Jeremy McGowan. OSIRIS, we love it. We can't wait to see it transform into a transformer someday. That's what I'm hoping for. Mm-hmm. But UAPX, you guys check that out, UAPX.space. Again, thank you, Jeremy, and I know we'll see you again, man.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Always a pleasure. Yes. And I did look up the date, Josh. It was February 24th of last year that we had Jeremy on. So darn
almost
near.
Yeah.
By, you know, like, just shy of a week or whatever since we had him on last time. And that was completely unintentional. It didn't even...
But yeah, it is, it's like 11 months and 3 weeks or something. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, pretty amazing stuff. Again, check out uapx.space. There's a lot of really cool information there. I know we are absolutely fascinated by this constantly. You know, like I said,
yeah,
Osiris, I'm like, if we could get out there and I just want to ride in it and watch the data being collected like right. that. I know you're like, ooh, how's this working? What's the engine sound like? I'm like,
I just want to look at the data and see if I can catch me a UFO. So, yeah, I mean, it just, yeah, I mean, all of it, right? And to be able to see it, to be able to ride in it, to be able to maybe go out and do an expedition, that would be awesome too. You know, I'll pay for gas, you know.
Yeah. I'll buy the Cheetos, man. Like,
does it run on Mr. Fusion? You know, we have a banana peel, it's a beer. I mean, so.
Is it that? Wasn't it like Willie Nelson uses like corn oil or something like that? He always did.
Biodiesel. Yeah.
No, but I mean, like back in the day, he would just buy like vegetable oil or whatever, and he would put it in his car, like or something a long time ago. I can't remember.
I mean, it's people buy used vegetable oil from restaurants and they use it to make biodiesel.
Right. Yeah.
So that's probably what you're thinking of. But yeah,
maybe. I don't know. It's Willie Nelson. So I was like, that man can do it every once. His beard says so.
Yeah, it was a very, you know, and I think the interview tonight with Jeremy really kind of fits in with, you know, kind of our theme, right, that we're trying to go after here. And that's, you know, collecting data points from all different avenues to see what else is kind of interacting and happening when these things kind of show up and happen. So to try to pinpoint down, you know, my ideal situation, they collect enough data to be able to use like AI or machine learning and predict when the next window and where the next window will be.
Yeah, that's kind of the hope, man. Keep an eye. I'm telling you, man, keep an eye on UAPX. I think some big things are going to be coming. Like I said, I miss TTSA dropping stuff, and we just don't see that anymore. So in the meantime, I've got my UAPX with some hard data, not just speculative. So I'm very excited about that. Josh, before we go, I want to remind people, we are now the Convergence Enigma. You can go to theconvergenceenigma.com and find the same information you used to find for Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. We are still a part of the Fearscape Media Network. That is not going away. Josh and I are still doing Tech Talk with the Debrief. I believe this week we've just dropped the Halo Infinite episode. So that's going to be, man, if you guys haven't watched that yet, it's Josh and I talking about all the technology within Halo Infinite
and kind of how it maybe translates to the real world. So
man, so that's really, really cool. You can go to thedebrief.org to check that, or just type in the Debrief Tech Talk into YouTube, as well as Astral Stew. We got an Astral Stew episode out as well, talking about love and the paranormal, man. Love in the astral plane,
alien love, it's all about it.
We got a lot going on, Josh, man. That's all I'm saying. Stick around next week. We've got another guest alumni coming on the show, Jim Schmidt, who wrote The Way of Existence, that really phenomenal book about one of his past lives that was just mind-blowingly good. He's going to be on with us discussing dimensional shifts, digging into the convergence enigma, into that theory, boy, let me tell you, because that plays a lot into all of this as well.
Yep, it certainly does.
So, but anyways, thank you guys so much for tuning in to the Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan. I have been your host, Stefan Gearhart, and I always want to remind you to please keep your eyes on the skies.
And this has been Josh, and the truth really is now. I mean, we are living in so much truth right now.
That's right. And just a reminder, folks, don't forget to keep searching and keep questioning. Good night, everybody.
Good night.